Lowe's knows you want the best for dad. This Father's Day, help him take on any project with big deals on DeWalt. Right now, get a free XR 8 amp hour battery when you buy select DeWalt tools. That's not all. Get up to two free select tools when you buy a select DeWalt 20 volt max battery kit. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a work load is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.
Whatever drama this current NBA Finals produces probably won't compare to the excitement of 40 years ago, when the Boston Celtics and Phoenix Suns played a Game 5 for the ages. Boston came into the championship series as heavy favorites, having won the title just 2 years earlier and 12 in its franchise history. The upstart Suns, on the other hand, were making their first finals appearance since joining the league in 1968. They finished just 42-40 during the regular season, but as longtime broadcaster Al McCoy points out, there was a noticeable difference in this team as it headed towards the playoffs.
Well, really what happened in the late stages of the season, the Suns were playing in New Orleans when the Jazz were in New Orleans, and Dick Van Arsdale, who was the original Sun and the captain of the team, broke his wrist, and it really tore up the Suns, and shortly afterwards, the next day, Coach John McLeod, on the bus, actually, went to every one of the Suns players and asked them, quite frankly, what are you here for, and made them make a commitment that they were going to come out and that they had a shot to make the playoffs, even though they lost their captain. And so on a bus ride to the airport, Coach McLeod kind of laid the ground rules down, and he got a firm commitment from the players. And they'd been a good group, a good together group, even though they were losing still at that time. But they finished strong in the last 20 games, and of course, as you know, finished just two above 500, 42-40. But did make the playoffs. So really, they went into the playoffs kind of under a full head of steam, emotionally at least.
As the third seed in the Western Conference, Phoenix beat the Seattle Supersonics in six, then upset the defending champion Golden State Warriors in seven games. Even with the specter of the famed Celtics looming, Rookie of the Year Alvin Adams and the rest of the Suns were full of confidence heading into the finals.
Back then, there were only, 18 or 20 or 22 teams, something like that. And you played the teams in the other conference more times than they do now. So we played, I think, the Celtics at least four times, if not more. But at that point in the season, because we finished real strong the last 30 days of the season, we had a really good closing record. I forget what exactly, 12-2 or something approximate to that. And we beat out the Lakers, and they had Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. But we peaked at the right time of the season. Our coaching staff, which back in those days was only two people, John McLeod and his assistant Al Bianchi, they had us prepared for every opponent. And they had us believing, and we believed, mostly because of the wins, that we could beat anybody we were playing on any given night. I know it's cliche, but we'd made an important late-season trade around the All-Star game for Garfield Hurd, and it gave us a real pretty good front line. We had the veterans in Gar Hurd and Curtis Perry, and we had me, a small running active center, which was not common at all in the league. And we were just thinking, doesn't matter who we're playing, it's game seven, we're playing Golden State on the road. No, we're just thinking we're playing somebody tonight. Let's do this and this and this. And we felt confident we could win. None of us sat before the game and predicted any that we were going to win. And then once we won, we didn't one way or the other go immediately. We didn't go, uh-oh, we haven't beat the Celtics this year, or uh-oh, they're really experienced. I thought we had a little bit of an advantage to some degree because we had Paul Westphal on the team, who just finished 3 years with them and knew all their tricks and where the dead spots were in the Boston parquet. But let's play the finals is what we were saying at that point.
Now, one of the key players on the Suns was Paul Westphal, a former Celtic just a year prior. How much did Westphal kind of have like an edge maybe on the Celtics, or how much did he provide insight to that Suns team?
Well, Paul would be the first to tell you that he was excited about having a chance to play his former team in the playoffs. And he did think he had a little edge because he'd been in a Boston uniform. He knew their plays. He thought he knew their strengths and their weaknesses. And, of course, the Suns had come off a great series against Golden State because Golden State had won the NBA championship the year before with Rick Barry and company. And there was a double overtime game in that series, as a matter of fact. So, again, the Suns were starting to get a little recognition, but when they went to Boston, that recognition faded away. But Paul Westphal, again, felt, because he had played in Boston, knew their plays, knew their personnel, that maybe he did have a little edge.
For you, going to Boston Garden, it's a place unlike any other, or was unlike any other in the NBA. What was it like being in that building, especially for an NBA Finals?
Well, obviously, as I mentioned, the Suns got no respect in Boston. In fact, the fans couldn't even realize that there was a team in Phoenix and how these guys wearing white socks and brown shoes and were Cowboys of Arizona could even be in the same building as the famed green Boston Celtics. But for a broadcaster, obviously, the Old Garden, where the games were played at that time, in 1976, was one of the classic sports arenas in the United States. So it was a thrill to be there. And all of us involved with the Suns that had saw them finish the season and what they'd done in the playoffs at that point didn't feel that they would be brushed away.
I think I looked at it more from a historical standpoint. I grew up watching the great teams, because only the great teams were on in the 60s and early 70s. Only the playoffs were on. I got to see Chamberlain and Russell and Lou Alcindor when he came into the league. So I only saw the really good teams. And, of course, that meant lots of games in Boston. And to me, it was an historical place. It was like, I don't know, going to the Parthenon or something in Athens or the Colosseum in Rome to some degree. And so might I have been in awe the first couple times we played there? I don't remember exactly, but I remember thinking, these are really smart fans. They've seen the best basketball there is in the world for the last 10 or 15 or 20 years. And I don't remember what I thought during the regular season, but I know we were thinking, well, okay, we haven't beat these guys, but what's the game plan for game one?
As the Suns lost the first two in Boston, did you have any belief that the pundits, who pretty much had predicted a short series, might be right?
Well, you know, obviously, going into Boston, they had so many championship banners that they had the edge from the emotional crowd, and it was disappointing to see the Suns lose the first two games. But I do have to tell you, on the plane ride going back to Phoenix, the players were up. They felt, let's get on our home court. We still can beat this team. And I think the big surprise to all of the Boston fans and the Celtics was the fact that the Suns did. And as everyone knows, they squared the series by winning the two games in Phoenix.
Yeah, they won the 2-2 at Phoenix. What was that atmosphere like, especially maybe for that game three, which was an overtime victory, an event that really hadn't happened before? So what was that like?
Well, the town was going crazy. I mean, fans were staying up all night in line, sleeping outside to get tickets. The Veterans Memorial Coliseum had already been tagged as the madhouse on McDowell, and it lived up to that reputation, obviously, in those two games. So the city was completely enthralled with the Suns, and being in the NBA Finals was just something that this city had never experienced. So Suns colors were everywhere, and the enthusiasm obviously was at an all-time high.
And so the fans were super excited, and back then the building only seated I want to say about 12,700. It was full and they were loud. And there was no timeout acts. There were no dancers. There was no mascots. There was not a lot of music. The only music I remember was dun, 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 dun. And yet the crowd was noisy the whole time, especially because, you know, it was the end of the season and we were good and there was lots to cheer about. And it was exciting. I think that game three was one of those Sunday noon games or something, so it was kind of weird, like, okay, what do I have for pregame meal? Is it my regular steak, or is it bacon and eggs? And I think all of us got thrown off by those midday starts, but I know there was a lot of rhetoric. Sonny Hill was a national broadcaster at the time that I think preseason had called us pumpkins, so our press had a lot of fun with that, and, you know, we heard some of that and read some of it. But we were intent on how do we keep JoJo from doing that? How do we keep Havlicek and Cowens and all that?
So with the series all square at two apiece, the teams headed back to Boston for the amazing Game 5, played on the night of June 4th.
Well, it was a classic night, I think, as everyone knows. It had a late start due to national television. I was doing the game on our Suns radio network, also on the old Mutual radio network, and on Armed Forces radio. And there was no air conditioning in the old Boston Garden, and it was an unusual warm, humid day that June night. And with the game not starting till 9 o'clock, you knew where all the fans had been prior to that, so it was a pretty wild and woolly place. And I've told this story many times, and I'll try and make it short for you, Brian, but when I got to my broadcast location that night, it looked as if they had actually sold the seats to fans right next to my broadcast location. And that's exactly what had happened. I won't go into a lot of detail, but about 10 minutes before I was to go on the air, here come three young guys, and they have tickets for the seats right next to me. And they have a big bag of six packs of beer and wine and chips, and they're ready to have a party. So throughout the broadcast, whenever the Celtics would hit a big shot, John Havlicek or whoever, Dave Cowens, I'd get a bump on the shoulder. Hey, how do you like that? How about that? And then just to move ahead, when Garfield Hurd hit the shot heard around the world that centered into the third overtime, this one guy jumped up and passed out right on my lap. And that's a true story. And that's what happened to me that night in Boston Garden, one I won't forget.
The way it started, falling 32-12, I think, after 9 minutes, what gave you guys the confidence that you could come back?
Well, I don't remember precisely, other than what I just keep saying, that at that point in the season, we knew we were one of the best teams in the league, one of the two best teams in the league. We'd just gone through the brackets, and we were there. And NBA games are long. You still see it today. Team gets down by 19 in the first quarter. They take the lead in the third quarter, you know, type of thing. So I don't think anything scared us. Not the dead spots in the floor. We had a balanced, we were really balanced. We had Dick Van Arsdale had broken his wrist somewhere in the second half of the season, was out for a number of weeks, and Ricky Sobers, the other first-round draft choice with me, filled in great. He was playing great. I don't remember what game he got in a fight with Kevin Steakum, probably one of the first two games. And back then, I don't think he ever got suspended but for ensuing games, but we felt we had the talent and the depth to compete and made it a game.
Hurd gets the ball from the referee. Hurd looks. He throws it underneath to Perry. It's knocked loose. Dwight gets it. But time has elapsed. The Suns did not get a shot. And we will go to overtime.
The controversy that took place at the end of the first overtime with Paul Silas signaling a timeout to Richie Powers when the Celtics had none remaining, did you happen to see that? And do you happen to think that was a blown call?
Oh, certainly. I mean, to me, that was the series. And it's so interesting that you mentioned that, Brian. I was just in Charlotte with the Suns, and that's where the gentleman you just mentioned, Paul Silas, lives. Mm-hmm. His son, Stevens, is an assistant coach there. And When I saw Paul and his wife, I gave him the T sign and laughed, and I said, we can't remember 1976. No, it was an obvious call, and as we all know, Richie Powers afterwards said he would not let an NBA championship be decided that way. Now, how that's up to a referee to make that decision is difficult to say, but the Suns to this day feel that cost them the championship, that call, which was an illegal call, should have been made, free throw could have been made, the Suns would have won and would have come home and eliminated Boston in Phoenix. But, as they say, that's in the past.
The ball to Nelson. He waits. They set it up. It comes to Havlicek. Deep in the corner. Havlicek's shot is not good. Second overtime coming up.
No, I don't remember seeing it. I've certainly heard about it. And Richie goes, something along the lines of, you don't have a timeout, or you can't call it, or I don't think it was, you don't want to do that, or else you'll lose the game. It wasn't that, I don't think. He said, no, you can. And then when we called our timeout, which you'll get to in a minute here, I'm sure he also told us, hey, you don't have another timeout. Yeah, we know, but we want to anyway. So, no, I know. Some of our fans, including Albie Inky, our assistant coach, thinks Richie robbed us of a championship. But even if we would have won right there, we still had to win one more game, and nothing's for granted. And it was, I think Richie was fair to both teams. He didn't call Paul's, and he warned us that we didn't have one either. So I don't hold it against Richie.
The end of the second overtime produced a string of events that simply defy description. We pick up the action with 19 seconds remaining and Phoenix down by 3.
Carher gets it into Van Arsdale. Van trying to drive, shoot from the corner. It's good! 15 seconds to go, Phoenix down by 1. Here's a steal by Westfall to Van Arsdale, to Perry. It won't go. Perry gets the rebound. Perry from the corner, scores it! Curtis Perry scores it! 5 seconds to go! Oh, I don't believe it! I do not believe it!
Phoenix has gone ahead! We've got 5 seconds! I don't believe it! I don't believe what I just saw down here! 110 to 109! I got 5 seconds! That was incredible! Where did Westfall come from?
But it was far from over, as Hall of Famer John Havlicek took the inbound.
Here come the Celtics. Clock will start when it's touched. Havlicek touches it. It begins. 3 seconds. Hondo off the glass. He's got it with a second. John Havlicek won it. It's over.
No, there's 2 seconds to go.
The Boston Celtics, but the clock should have run out. Or did it have two?
Everybody's on the floor. Go in this basketball game, Brent. The ball went in with 2 seconds to go, and the clock has to stop on a made basket.
The swings of emotion, Al, in this game were unbelievable, and I think no better example than that sequence there.
Well, you hit the nail on the head. It was absolutely unbelievable. And I think we have to realize that in these overtimes, the building was so hot, so uncomfortable, that these players were completely drained. I mean, they were all playing on sheer emotions. And you don't want to forget that the Suns had lost. Their two centers had both fouled out. Alvin Adams was the rookie of the year that year had fouled out. Dennis Autry, his backup, had fouled out. And players were just, they were competing on sheer emotion. But that sequence was absolutely unbelievable. And, of course, when Havlicek hit that shot, the fans thought the game was over. They rushed on the floor, and, well, you know what happened then.
Did you know immediately after that Havlicek shot went in that the clock had not run out?
Well, we felt that, and I had Tom Ambrose, who was our public relations director at that time, was keeping stats for me, and we both felt that, we said the game's not over.
Hold the phone! Hold the phone! The Celtic fans are going bananas! The game is not over! I don't think the game is over! There's 2 seconds remaining, I do believe!
Even though the fans are out there and Richie Powers is getting involved with the fans, we said, this game isn't over. The time is, the clock has not run out. And it, fortunately, it had.
To go. This
fight
game is
Richie
not
Powers.
Over.
Richie Powers is in a fight with a fan right here in front. Referee Richie Powers was assaulted by a fan. They pulled the boar off.
And the guy that saved him was Curtis Perry of the Suns, who pushed the guy away and grabbed Richie and pulled him away to safety. I don't know if that was a good idea for Curtis Perry or not, and he laughs about it today, saying, maybe I never should have done that. And, of course, there was no security in the building, but that was Boston. Never any security. In fact, from the fourth quarter on, Coach John McLeod of the Suns could not have a normal timeout because fans were getting up behind the bench and getting involved with the Suns players, so they'd have to go out almost to the free throw line to have their timeout huddles.
As I remember, we didn't leave the floor. As I remember, we figured there was time left, but hey, you're on the road, and hey, you're in Boston. And Paul always told us about the little things that the Celtics could do, whether the temperature in the visitor locker room was set to 86 degrees. That's my number. I don't remember Paul saying that, but something way too warm, and you're in there melting before the game, or whether it's one of their players tugging on you as you're trying to drive and pulling your shirt down and forcing an offensive call. You figure, well, you don't know, you're on the road, you're in Boston. But Richie was on top. He said, there's a second left, and it probably helped. I don't know, maybe he gave Paul that extra time to go, hey, there's a rule. Hey, Coach McLeod, we can do this. And because if they would have been, hey, there's a second, they wouldn't have charged the floor. Well, there may not have been time to think that through.
So the Westfall strategy, that was, you know, that was something he, what you're based on what you're saying, that was something he conjured up. Did he like bring it up in the huddle to the coaches going, you know, hey, what about this rule that we can, you know, call a timeout, even though we don't have one, they'll shoot a free throw, but we'll get the ball back at half court? Was that something that was discussed?
Yeah, and I didn't hear that because there was a lot of, hey, get that guy away from our bench, and hey, this guy's drunk, and so I wouldn't use the word conjured up. He pulled it up from the depths of his competitive, I know all the rules on mind, and because I've seen some of that video, I see him talking to the coach, and the coach is kind of going, yeah, okay, all right, kind of that look of, yeah, that does make sense. And then there's some talking to Richie, which goes, no, well, you don't have that. I didn't read lips, but something along those lines of, you don't know, we know that, but we'll get the ball at half court if they get the technical, whether they make the shot or not. Yeah, that's true. Okay.
And, of course, that only points out the basketball smarts of a player like Paul Westfall, who obviously knew the rule, and he's the one that actually said to Coach John McLeod, I'm going to call the timeout. We can move the ball up. And as I said, we might not have been as aware of it as a broadcaster if we had not had the Paul Silas incident earlier. So I guess we were more aware of if you called a timeout, it was a technical, there was a free throw, and oh, look what might happen.
After the technical foul was given to Phoenix and the court was cleared of fans, eventual Finals MVP JoJo White hit a free throw to put Boston up by 2. But the Suns now had a chance to tie it up as they inbounded from half court.
This has been one of the more incredible evenings in the history of championship play in the NBA. Leading by 22 points, the Boston Celtics found themselves tied once and then twice. And now we come to the end of the second overtime with a couple of the most incredible turnarounds I have ever seen. It is John Havlicek who put the Celtics ahead. Then the Suns took the technical to get court position. Curtis Perry wanted somebody to stand back. Won't start until it's touched. They'll have to throw it up. Gorher, turnaround, shot in the air. It's good. It's tied again. I don't believe it. Garfield heard at the buzzer. Threw one in outside. We've got a third overtime in a Boston Garden. It's 112-112.
I got to take a breather. Garfield heard. Made the basket. I want to tell you something. Somebody up there is on our side. And justfully so. We will go to the third amazing overtime period.
Did you feel at that time the Suns had all the momentum on their side?
Yes, I did. And the final overtime boiled down to one player who had not played and was the only fresh player on the court. And you know who that was for Boston.
Yeah, it was Glenn McDonald, right? How many?
Glenn McDonald, right.
Yeah.
Because believe me, in that third overtime, Brian, players could hardly get up and down, the floor. The guys had played so many minutes, it was so hot and humid in that building. And the one fresh face was Glenn McDonald. And to this day, Coach John McLeod says his biggest mistake, he had a player named Nate Hawthorne on the bench who hadn't played. He said his biggest mistake was not playing Nate Hawthorne in that third overtime to go against Glenn McDonald. He thought that would have been the difference because they would have been the only two fresh players on the floor. And as it was, Glenn McDonald was the only one. He was able to get to the hoop and score, and that turned out to be the ball game.
16 seconds. Here's the pass for Westfall. There for the layup. He gets it. Suns are within two. 12 seconds to go. 128-126 Boston. Nelson in backcourt. 9 seconds to play. Westfall went for the steal. Couldn't get it. Hard is there to White. 5 seconds to go. Now four. Now three. Now two. Now one. It is over. Boston has won it in three overtime.
In the locker room, was the feeling after the game mostly dejection of having come so far and losing it, now being down 3-2? Was there a sense of optimism that you guys could really play with the Celtics on their home floor? What was it mostly that you remember?
I don't remember exactly, but it certainly wasn't, oh no, we've lost the series. It was, well, crud. We didn't win that one. That was quite the game. Let's get out of here. Make sure no one assaults us on the way out. No offense, Boston fans. But let's make sure we get out of here. And game six is in whatever it was, 2 or 3 days. And of course, we flew commercial back then, so I don't remember if we missed our flight or if we went out the next morning. I can't remember because that was an afternoon game, too. I don't remember. I think we flew back the next day and we got ready for game six. And so I don't remember any, hey, we can't win a game. It was more the opposite, like you said, like, hey, we can play these guys. It was 2-2. This was a triple overtime loss. So we're fine. We're going home. Let's go home and win the next game and force a game seven.
Game six, however, did not go as planned for Phoenix. An 87-80 Boston victory, and the Celtics had their 13th NBA championship. In the aftermath, being around the team, as you have for more than 40 years now, you must have talked with tons of fans about that game and heard about that game from the fans' perspective, and probably a lot of them recalling your call of the game.
And I still do. And for many, many years, I would hear from people where they were. Some of them might be in the supermarket shopping, and they would stop checking people out, and they had the radio broadcast up on their PA system, and people would not leave the store. They just stayed there and listened to that game. And I heard a lot of comments from people that had heard the game on Armed Forces Radio in Japan and China. And for many, many years, I had comments from letters and calls and people that had heard that game and where they were at that particular point in time. It was a big, and it really, that team and that playoff series, Brian, really made Phoenix an NBA city for many, many reasons.
Is there any bit that's bittersweet, specifically referring to Game 5, or do you take pride, especially with the effort that was put in by that entire team, in being a game that's still regarded as the greatest in NBA history?
Oh, wow. I look at it, I mean, for years after I retired, someone said, well, how many good years did you have? And when someone says you to me in a team sport, I'm thinking our team. I go, well, I don't know. Divide my career, I could probably divide it into thirds as a team thing. We had 4 or so years where we exceeded our potential. We had 4 years or so where we were below our potential. We didn't make the playoffs. We got beat by somebody we really shouldn't have lost to in the playoffs. And about 4 years or so, I know it only adds up to 12, but roughly 13 years, where we kind of met our potential. We got beat by Magic's team in the Lakers a couple years. Well, we weren't going to beat them unless there was a major injury or something. And that year, by far, we exceeded our potential the most. And so I've kind of gotten, yeah, well, what was special about that year? The only thing I can think of, it was the closest team I ever played on. It was the most married team. team I was ever played on. I mean, if someone put me in charge of a team today, I wouldn't say, hey, all you guys get married. I'm not saying that, but we did more things together, and we did more things together as couples. And I don't know that we had any more new players that year than we did in an average year. Probably a little bit more, but it was the best year because it was new and we did things together and we exceeded our potential. It was the only year I ever played on a team that got to the NBA Finals. So it was the most special year for me.
Now for an ironic postscript. Only one other time has an NBA Finals game gone as far as three overtimes. Well, that also featured the Suns. Game 3 in 1993 against the Chicago Bulls, with Phoenix coached by none other than Paul Westphal. This time, the Suns came away with a win, even though they'd eventually lose the series.
It's rare to have the privilege to broadcast an NBA Finals game that goes to three overtimes, and you've done it twice. How often were you, during that game, were you thinking about the 76 game and referring it to it maybe during the broadcast?
Oh, no question about it. Of course, the good news was I was on the floor broadcasting in Chicago, which is the place to be. Unfortunately, we aren't on the floor in many NBA cities anymore, and that takes away from what we can contribute to the game. But I was on the floor, and obviously, when it went into overtime, we would say, now, can this possibly go three overtimes as it did in 1976 in Boston? And, of course, it was on our mind and was in our broadcast, definitely.
A great thanks to Alvin Adams and Al McCoy for their perspective on the greatest game in NBA history. I'm Brian Wright, and this is Profiles in Sports.
Fans swarming all over the floor here. Chatty, we're number one. But I want to tell you, Phoenix made them work for it tonight. And this is Brent Musburger for Mindy Rudolph, Rick Barry, and Sonny Hill saying goodbye from the Boston Garden, where you have just watched the most incredible game in the history of the NBA.
Looking to upgrade your bathroom without the hassle or the wait? Say hello to Blissful Baths, the stress-free way to transform your space into a relaxing retreat. Right now, Blissful Baths is offering 12 months with no payments and no interest. That's right, zero payments and zero interest for a whole year. Even better, they can replace your walk-in shower or bath in as little as one day. No mess, no long waits, just a beautiful new bath space, fast. And here's the cherry on top. You can get up to 20% off with instant manufacturer rebates, plus extra savings for seniors and first responders. Ready to turn your bathroom into your own personal spa? Go to blissfulbaths.com today to request your free consultation. That's blissfulbaths.com. You deserve affordable luxury.